welcome to Inside Education. My name is Sean Delaney. Coming up in today's program...
My father was a fisherman, and he had ambitions for us to go to sea. So there was that tension between the ambitions of my father and my mother, but my mother's ambitions won out.
And that ambition brought John Carr all the way to the top of Ireland's largest teachers' union. I'll bring you the first of a two-part interview with the recently retired General Secretary of the Irish National Teachers' Organisation. But first today we go to this week's Education News Roundup with Barry Hennessy. You're welcome once again, Barry.
Hello, Sean.
Barry, it's yes from the primary teachers and no from the secondary teachers. What conclusions, if any, can we draw from this week's ballot results?
I suppose, Sean, the obvious observation first off is that the unions have come out of the ballot process divided. The INTO's decision to vote yes wouldn't be unexpected in that they've tended to go with every national agreement and pay deal in recent times. But the margin of the victory for the yes side in the INTO, 65-35, was perhaps greater than might have been expected.
And greater than would have been expected from the INTO conference result.
Yes, because at the INTO Congress, which of course you attended for us back in April, there was a debate on the floor regarding whether the union should actually recommend rejecting the deal. And the margin between the two sides, that motion was lost by four votes. So the union came out of its Congress very divided, but the rank and file members now have voted a fairly strong yes vote, which I think reminds us that sometimes the conference floor doesn't exactly reflect the rank and file, what the rank and file members are going to say when they're asked a question. And we could even apply that to the ASTI, I think, where although that union did vote no in the ballot, which was what they had been asked to do by their executive committee and their standing committee, the margin was 62% to 38, which is hardly an overwhelming no vote. Now, I've been sounding out quite a few teachers over the course of the last week, and empirically the impression that I get is that younger post-primary teachers, and one assumes even in primary as well, were more likely to vote yes. Many of them would have financial commitments stemming from the Celtic Tiger era, whereas certainly in post-primary it was perhaps more senior teachers who were maybe more wed to the terms and conditions of employment that they have had right through their professional careers that were more likely to oppose the deal.
And that would make sense, Barry, because about half of the primary school teachers have been teaching for less than 10 years, so they have a higher profile of younger teachers than the other two unions.
Well, it's just an empirical observation, Sean, of course, because clearly we don't have that kind of a breakdown in front of us, but it'll be very interesting. I don't know whether we have any ambitious researchers listening who'd like to go and look at that. I suppose in terms of where we go from here, it's going to be very interesting to see what the TUI's next course of action is. Now, that union was the one that gave the most resounding no by about a 3-1 margin. And its General Secretary, Peter McMenamin, in common with all of the significant figures in TUI, have been making the point that they won't necessarily be bound by the majority decision on this pay deal when all of the unions have voted. They've used phrases like the tyranny of the majority. But Mr. McMenamin, in his statements over recent days, has been much more measured and conciliatory in the note that he's striking, refusing to say exactly what the TUI may do from here. Certainly, if the nuclear option of stepping outside ICTU was to be considered, the last time any of the teaching unions did that, it was the ASTI about 10 years ago, and they found being outside the ICTU fold quite a lonely place, the government very much holding the line at that time about going into the benchmarking process. And if the government could hold a line in those plentiful times, one imagines that anybody trying to go it alone in the current climate will probably meet a very, very resolute government response. If anything, the sense this weekend is one of the need for dialogue, and this is being said both openly and behind closed doors, to the extent that John White, the outgoing General Secretary of the ASTI, in a media interview yesterday, said that he wanted to see a negotiated solution to the dilemma now posed by his union's rejection of the Croke Park deal. A very senior and well-placed source in the INTO, whom I spoke to just before coming on the air, made the point that his union has now been mandated by its members to renegotiate the teaching contract. That's what it says. It's a renegotiation with the Department of Education, not a dictation of the terms of the new teaching contract. So the overall sense is that the teaching unions will meet as a group when the final result of the ballot is known, and certainly over the summer it looks as if there'll be some push for dialogue. We don't know, of course, the mood in which teachers will return to their classrooms in September, of course.
And Barry, you also have another news report for us.
Well, this is from the ASTI. I know we've been talking about the unions, but it's in a rather different vein. They held their conference yesterday in Dublin for new and young teachers. The union says that less than 10% of newly qualified secondary teachers secure permanent employment within a year of graduating, and more than half of those aged under 30 are on temporary contracts of 1 year or less. But the eyebrows, if they're going to be raised after yesterday's ASTI conference, will be raised by a proposal which was put forward and presented by the union's president, Joe Moran, in which he's called for an induction year for newly qualified teachers. Now, that's an arrangement that exists in Scotland and in Finland, both of which are often touted as having close to model education systems. But it's a very serious issue, this, because it obviously is indicative of a significant oversupply of post-primary teachers. That's something that's very difficult to address in the context of EU law, but also the prospect of a first year teaching on low earnings, a kind of an internment year, could be a real disincentive to prospective teachers.
Our internship.
Yeah, and potentially, you know, there are real issues here, I think, regarding, I suppose, the status of teaching that I know many education commentators will be concerned about. But insofar as the suggestion of an internship year or an induction year has now been tabled by the president of a major teaching union, we'll have to look at it. And I think what we're going to try to do, Sean, in future programmes is talk to people in Scotland and in Finland and try to find out exactly what their experience of that kind of an arrangement is.
Barry, thanks very much for this week's news. And we'll talk to Barry again next week on the programme. This is Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. You can get in touch with the programme by texting 086 8962 665. We like to get your feedback and suggestions for future programs. Podcasts of previous programs can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website, which is www.insideed.com. A few weeks ago, at the annual Congress of the Irish National Teachers Organisation, the organisation's General Secretary, John Carr, was succeeded by Sheila Noonan. John Carr's retirement closed a chapter in the book of one of the most influential people in Irish primary education over the past two decades. On Inside Education, we wanted to find out more about John Carr, the educator and the trade unionist. Beginning this week, we bring you the first of a two-part interview with John Carr. In this week's interview, we focus on his time as an educator at primary school level. He grew up in the late 1940s and 50s in a town in North Donegal called Downings, where he attended the local three-teacher Irish-speaking national school. His father was a fisherman and his mother had the opportunity to become a primary teacher but had to turn it down in order to support her family. John himself won a scholarship to study in St. Enda's Preparatory College Secondary School in Galway, and on completing his Leaving Cert there in 1965, he was among the first group of students admitted to St. Pat's College by open competition rather than the previous system where most places were allocated to those who had attended the two preparatory colleges in Ballyvourne and Galway. John begins this piece by referring briefly to the curriculum he experienced in St. Pat's in the 2 years from 1965 to 1967.
It was very, very intensive because it was a two-year programme. It didn't have degree status at the time, and it was certainly geared to bringing you our high level of competency in every area from Irish, English and all the curriculum subjects.
So after 2 years then you qualified, and you this year have been honoured because you're Donegal Man of the Year, but you didn't actually head back to Donegal as might have been expected after your time in St. Pat's.
Well, it was my intention to go back to Donegal, mainly, I suppose, my parents were getting older at the time and I wanted to be close by to them. My father had given up fishing and, you know, there were health-related issues, etc. And at the time, schools used to advertise in the College of Education, and advertisement did not take place much in the newspapers. And indeed, a lot of people were appointed on word of mouth and knowing people here and there. But in my particular case, I was walking past the notice board when the vice president of the college, Father Philip Walsh, was passing by, and he said, "Are you looking for a job?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm looking for a job in Donegal." And he said, "Well, my advice to you is take a job in Dublin first, because if you go straight away up to Donegal, you'll be sitting in on a wet winter's night and you'll be saying, like, why didn't I stay in Dublin? I could be now at the theatre or the cinema or whatever." And then he said, if you spend a year in Dublin and you're living in flats and Rathmines and etc. and cooking for yourself and looking after yourself, you then go to Donegal and you'll say, well, it's misery here tonight, but at least it's better than being in Dublin. So he came with me down to his room and he dictated a letter to a school in Dublin. I applied along with a lot of others, obviously, at the time to this particular school in Finglas, but it happened to be a Clannagale school, and Clannagale was the local football team, and the teachers in that school were recruiters for the local club, and there were 16 vacancies in that particular or in the area, and I never even got called for an interview because obviously my prowess on the football field wasn't good enough for Clannagale at the time. And as a result, I didn't, of course, get the job, but I subsequently applied for St. John the Baptist School and Clontarf Belgrove Schools, as they're known, and I was appointed. It wasn't what you'd call an easy interview, but I had done teaching practice in the school. One of the teachers recognised me, and, of course, that's how I got the job.
And you went to Belgrove School shortly after another famous teacher there, John McGahern, had been forced to resign.
Well, when I came to Belgrove first, we were barely aware of John McGahern. I remember the late Jackie Brosnan coming into the College of Education in St. Pat's.
He
was General Secretary of the INTO. And he came in, as was customary at the time, that the General Secretary would come in to talk to us to make sure we all join the INTO. And I remember a guy called Pat Butler, I think it was Pat or Alan Titley, but I think it was Pat Butler, who probably would have been more aware than we were at the time, but he posed the question to Jackie Brosnan, what did you do for John McGahern? And I remember well the shuffling and the avoidance, as it were, of answering the question. But that's all I knew, really, of John McGahern until I arrived at Clontarf. But then there was a wall of silence, I suppose, the only way I could describe it, when I arrived. Nobody talked about John McGahern, even though he had only been gone for a couple of years previously. But when the leave-taking was published in 1974, and that would mean I'd be in the school for 7 years at the time, the whole John McGahern saga began to unfold, because in the book he obviously was referring to people teaching in the school. I remember being told when I was there that Canon Carton, or Father Carton as he was at that particular time, that he didn't want to dismiss John McGahern.
He would have been the chairperson of the school.
He would have been the manager, yes, of the school at the time. And he wasn't in favour of... because John McGahern was a good teacher and he was popular within the staff. And like I've known former students... who used to describe him as looking out the window often as if he was in a world of his own and wandering in his own imagination, as it were. But Canon Carton did not want to dismiss him. That was the story at the time. And he asked him to come down to the back of the church and that he would give him a blessing or whatever so that he wouldn't need to dismiss him. But then there was talk then of a petition that was drawn up by Pairns at the time, but there was question marks as to who was behind it, but it was Pairns who didn't want their children in John McGahern's class because of the I suppose he had challenged the Moors. He was asked, and I see it in the leave taking, in the book itself, he was asked by the principal, that there was rumours that he was married, but he was still on the single scale, because there was two different scales. There was a marriage scale and a single scale at the time. And that he retorted back to the principal and said, yes, he was married, but he was married in a registry office. And so there would have been strong forces probably within the school itself, and but mainly from without. And, of course, it was the era of Archbishop McQuaid. And
he would have been the patron of the school.
He would have been the patron at the time. And, I mean, John McGahan would have openly challenged the Moors of the at the time, and there would have been people who would be heavily committed towards you know, religion and a particular ethos. And I suppose John challenged that ethos, and he was living that challenge. But it was a sorry enough saga, in the sense that, you know, subsequently when Eileen Flynn in New Ross, when she was challenged, the system came to her aid. But unfortunately, in John McGarren's case, for a variety of reasons, and there are all sorts of rumours. There were all sorts of rumours at the time they come into the INCO that the INCO asked him to regularise his marriage. He wasn't a member at the time, because when he went on sabbatical, he of course naturally gave up his membership, and then when he came back, he hadn't rejoined. And incidentally, we did reconcile with John McGahan when Jimmy Collins was president of the INTO.
And John, getting back to yourself then, as a beginning teacher in this school, what kind of a teacher were you, and what class were you teaching?
I was teaching, my first class was the second class. I recall it very, very well. They were a class regarded at the time as being difficult by those in the school. And I mean, a lot of people said to me at the time, and said subsequently, that I shouldn't be given this class. But this class were probably the best class I ever taught, in the sense I got the best enjoyment from them. I recall, because I was new out of college, because I was innocent, I suppose, as much as anything else, I recall entering them for the Choralia, which was a festival of music for schools. And I'd probably be the first time that anybody from Clontarf was entered. But in that class in 1967 was Hugh O'Leary. And Hugh was the son of Maureen Potter. And we also had a Ryan chap there. And I, if I can recall correctly, he was a son of Maeve Ryan, who was Jerry Ryan's, the late, unfortunately, Jerry Ryan's mother. But anyway, she was a Burke. I recall very, very vividly that she brought in the children, herself and Maureen Potter, into Burke's in Dame Street. They were outfitters for theatre people at the time. And of course, when we went on the stage, everybody was dressed in theatrical gear. But it was also exciting in that we were the, as it were, the pioneers or the crusaders and the forerunners to the new curriculum. And I was very, very interested in art at the time, and my room became an Aladdin's cave, because I had mobiles from the ceiling, and at the time we were in an old prefab hut, which is incidentally still there, and all through those years, I'm not sure it's used as a classroom, but it's still standing. So I was determined to make this classroom into something special, and so that I had this belief that children should be coming in to, you know, a proper environment. I recall doing a project on sugar. And we had sugar beet, because I was very friendly, let's put it, with a woman from Carlow whom I subsequently married. And when she went home at the weekend, and she brought me back sugar beets, because her father used to tin sugar beet down around the fields in Carlow. And we also got sugar cane, I recall, from Cuba, I think, above all places. But we had granules and cubes of sugar from countries all over the world, because two or three of the children in my class had parents and had a father who was a pilot, and they, everywhere they went, they brought back sugar. And we used to be, like, I mean, it was all sugar, but it was different forms of it, and the excitement that, that the children got out of that. So by the end of the year, children who were regarded as difficult, I found them a great bunch of people, and I suppose from a teaching point of view, they made me what I subsequently became in Belgrove, like committed to teaching and to the arts, and the importance of the arts in developing children's imagination.
And John, what did you find most difficult about teaching?
Well, I suppose at the time you were talking about extra large classes. I recall having 42s, 3s and 4 in the class and second class. And you had the old desks at the time, because there was no room to put children into tables and chairs. so that class size became an issue. And I recall, you know, the methodology at the time was to group children into A, B, or C, group A, B, or C. The brighter children, you know, giving them more time to work on their own. And the weaker children then, you'd concentrate on those children. But it was so difficult to try to bring out the full potential. And even though we were trained in and a broader curriculum to bring, you know, to bring a sense of awe and wonder into teaching, and, you know, to open up the magic cave, as it were, of the imagination. Unfortunately, it was very, very difficult to do at that time.
John, you became a principal at a young age. You were only in your 20s, I think. How did that come about?
Well, in 1974, the boards of management were established in primary schools. And in 1976 then, I would probably have been the first principal, certainly the first young principal, to be appointed under a new system, which had a selection board, which consisted of the chairman of the board of management, who was a priest at the time, and two outsiders. As a result of probably new thinking, I was into new ideas in terms of art and music, and, you know, more probably enlightened viewpoints. I'm not saying they were better or worse, but they would be more enlightened in the mid 70s. And as a result, I was appointed the principal in Belgrove.
And what was that experience like of being a leader of teachers?
Well, it was a tough time. First of all, I was young. I didn't have too many years to establish myself. I was involved in sports a lot within the school. I was involved in other activities. So I had built up a street cred, as it were, in terms of involvement. But there were a lot of senior people on the staff. And I recall vividly Mrs. Cahill. She came to me on the Monday I took over, and she asked me to sign her notes. And I said, well, why do you want me to sign your notes? And she said, well, in case the inspector comes in. I wanted to make sure that my notes were signed. And I said to her that day, I said, Mrs. Cahill, I said, you know more about teaching infants than I'll ever know. And as a result, I'm going to devise a system in this school that will eliminate the need for you to have to come in a subservient way, as I felt it was at the time, and ask me to sign her notes, because she was the expert in teaching infants, and what was I other than just trying to fulfil an administrative role in case some inspector came in. So that set off a chain of events which culminated in the development of a school plan from junior infants to second class, because we were a junior school at the time. And we spent many, many hours. I redeployed the vice principal, Eta McGrath, to work on the development, and she took groups of teachers together, the teachers of infants who finished an hour earlier than the first and second class teachers. They would take the class of the first and second class teachers and free them to develop a program, a continuous program, developmental program from junior infants to second. It had the advantage of opening up the school, because prior to that, teaching was kind of egg crate type of activity, where you went into your class, you closed your door, and you peeped into the class next door when the teacher wasn't there to see what they were doing. This had the advantage of opening up the school. We produced a very, very elaborate document, folder, as it were, and I recall handing it to an inspector one day, and I said, there you are, this is what we're doing in our school. If you have any difficulty with it, come back to us. And, of course, the inspector never came back. But it did empower the teachers. It made them justify their practices and procedures, but it also empowered them to become more professional, because they now were making choices together on behalf of their pupils.
And they were sharing ideas and talking about teaching, which is something that is quite hard to do in school.
Well, it was novel at the time, in the sense that school planning hadn't become an integral part of school life. And it also had the effect of opening up minds to different, and sharing as well, I recall, was a very, very important part of it, because people had poems, teachers had poems that was part of their own repertoire, as it were, but never shared. Now teachers were putting all the collection of poems together, because we had supplements then, a supplement on physical education, a supplement on poetry, a supplement on stories. I recall we even had a supplement on St. Bridget, another one we did on St. Patrick. But the important part of the exercise was not the product, it was the process, and the process was teachers learning from each other, sharing each other, and the program that we developed was developmental, in the sense that we weren't repeating. We even had workbooks designed ourselves based on our maths program, not based on coming from the companies.
But it also, John, involved creative use of the staff that were available to you in the school, like, for example, redeploying the deputy principal, like doing some teaching yourself. Do you think that schools should have more freedom themselves as regards how they use the teachers that are assigned to a particular school?
Well, I've always held the view that teachers should be given a certain amount, or that schools rather should be given a certain amount of teaching staff, and that the school should be given the freedom to redeploy the staff based on the best interest of pupils and teachers at a particular time. Now, this type of thinking is becoming more and more prevalent at the moment, because people are looking towards Finland and trying to bring in Finnish ideas. Finland has the schools are given a greater, or believed to have a greater amount of autonomy than schools have here in Ireland. Now, I don't necessarily agree at primary level that they do. They may have at post-primary level. But I would favour a system whereby there would be a mechanism to allocate a certain number of teachers to a school, and that the school then would be responsible for the deployment of staff. I mean, I have no difficulty with larger numbers in one class, provided the next class has smaller numbers. And in other words, if the needs of the children are that they can learn in a bigger group, then let them have a bigger group, as long as you have an average of. And I, having taught infants myself when I was in Belgrove, I believe it's criminal and morally wrong to be putting 30-plus four-year-olds into a room with one adult.
And we'll bring you the second part of that programme on next week's programme. that interview. That's it for this week on Inside Education. You can download podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com or from iTunes. Thanks to John Carr from the INTO and to Barry Hennessy for the education news. Till the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.